dates are important. They mark moments when particular things happen to us. We mark dates, don't we? We mark our birthdays, at least if you're not getting too old. We mark wedding anniversaries, and we are upset if our husband or wife forgets them. And for all of us, there are different days that stick in our minds, significant days. We don't always remember the exact date, but they're always there in our minds. Perhaps it's the day your first child was born. Perhaps you remember the day you started at a new school or in a new workplace. One day that sticks in my mind, I had to look up the date, I didn't remember it. It's the 2nd of May 1997. And it was a bright, spring, sunshiny day. And the reason I remember it so well is it was the day we moved into our first house, the first house that we bought. It also happened to be the day after a general election, and the government had just changed for the first time in 18 years. So it felt like a day of change and newness. So that memory's just stuck with me. And you'll have days that stick in your minds. Some of them you know the date very well, and some of them you just remember the day. Well, one of the features in this book of Haggai that we've been studying together is that we are told the exact dates that these messages were given. And that's not unique to Haggai. Some of the other prophets do that at times. So in Zechariah and parts of Ezekiel and Daniel, you see the same thing. But that tells you that it was important. God gave these prophecies, it's part of his word. It was important for Haggai to record the exact day on which each of his prophecies, including the one we're looking at tonight, were given. In fact, when you combine this information with the history that people have worked out, you can identify almost to the exact day the day in history when these things happened. Those of you who were here earlier in the series and picked up one of the these timetables that I produced, I think there's still a couple on the table at the back if you want one. I've actually written down some dates which one of the commentators at least think that they happened in our calendar. For this one, they've got the 18th of December 520 BC. Well, there's always a little bit of uncertainty about historical dates, but not a lot. We do know to almost the precise day when this message was given. And in the date, the calendar that Haggai's using, we know exactly which day it was. It was the 24th day of the ninth month in the second year of Darius, the Persian emperor. So what we're talking about here, what we have here, are messages given by a particular man on a particular date in history. And that reminds us, first of all, that this isn't a fairy story, this isn't a legend. This is actual historical fact. This happened. A man stood up. He heard a message from God. And he spoke these words to real people on a real day in history. Except it wasn't history then. It was today, the day they heard it. And the other thing that we learn from that is that we can pinpoint exactly when this message was given relative to the other events that were happening at the time. So dates that are given by Haggai himself and by the prophet Zechariah and in the book of Ezra. So let me just remind you of of the background so that we can see how this message fits in to those dates. So what's happened so far? A group of Israelites has returned from exile in Babylon back to the land of Israel. Their intention when they came back, in fact the command they were given by the emperor, was to rebuild the temple in Jerusalem, which remember had been destroyed years earlier when all the people were taken into exile. They were coming back to rebuild God's temple and to try and re-establish their nation. And when those original exiles returned, that was an act of courage. It was an act of faith in God and in his promises. Those people, when they came back, they were leaving behind their homes, their houses, the communities that most of them had grown up in, to make a new start in a land that most of them had never even seen. But after a bright start, things started to go wrong. Opposition arose from the people already living around them, and those people were forced to stop building the temple. And so since that day, since they stopped the building work, they've spent their time planting crops, building nice homes for themselves, and trying to establish comfortable lifestyles. And yet nothing has gone right for them. Nothing has worked. You know, we read today in the passage just what life has been like in the years since they stopped building the temple. This is what it says in verse 16. When one came to a heap of 20 measures, there were but 10. When one came to the wine vat to draw 50 measures, there were but 20. I struck you and all the products of your toil with blight and with mildew and with hail. These people have been working hard. They've been toiling. They've been labouring. They've been trying to grow crops. They've been trying to make wine. And yet, it's just felt as if all their work's been for nothing. One man has 20 measures of wheat from last year's harvest. And he comes to get some wheat, and it's shrunk. It's been eaten by the ants, or it's turned to mildew, it's rotted away. Another man tries to grow grapes, and his wine, his grapevines just wither. They die of blight. Their life has just been frustration and hunger and failure. And we can read more about that in Haggai chapter 1. We thought about it a few weeks ago. And that's been the story for perhaps the past 14 or 15 years. This life of people trying to establish comfortable lifestyles for themselves, but finding life is just frustration. It's just not working. Nothing, all their plans fail. Just nothing works out. Life's been difficult. But 3 months before today's message was given, a prophet, a man called Haggai, stood up and spoke a message from God to these people. And it was a simple message. It was this. He said, "The reason that everything's been going wrong for you is that you've been ignoring me. You should have been building my house, my temple. Start rebuilding it now." That was the message. And the people listened to the message, and they obeyed the message. They gathered together. They said, on this particular day, we'll get together and start the work. And they did. They began the hard, back-breaking work of clearing away the ruins, of going into the forests and bringing wood, of going into the quarries and bringing in stones. And they started that building project. The new temple is just starting to take shape. It's been hard work, back-breaking work. And there's a real danger, even now, that they might give up the work. Last week, we looked together at the message of encouragement that God had to send them through Haggai to help them keep going. That message came perhaps, well, it did come 4 weeks after the work had started. And the prophecy that we're looking at tonight was given about 2 months after the original prophecy. But in between, something else has happened. And we can work that out from the dates. Another prophet, a man called Zechariah, has also received a message from God. And he's spoken that message to the people. And that's the message, the passage that we read right at the start of the service. It comes in Zechariah and chapter 1. If you want to turn over, it's on the next page. You can see Zechariah chapter 1 verse 1. It says, in the 8th month, in the 2nd year of Darius, the word of the Lord came to the prophet Zechariah. So if you look at your dates, you'll see they've started the building. They've had that message of encouragement that we looked at last week in the 7th month. And then Zechariah has spoken in the 8th month. And now the message we're looking at today is in the 9th month. So Zechariah's message has come in between Haggai's two prophecies. And the message that Zechariah has given is a hugely important message. God spoke to them and he reminded them of their rebellious forefathers. Zechariah chapter 1 verse 2, the Lord was very angry with your fathers. Their rebellious ancestors were the ones who disobeyed God in the first place. They were the ones who'd called down God's judgment on the nation. They were the ones whose fault it was that God had had to send judgment and destroy the temple in the first place. That was the reason why they'd been sent into exile. And God had given those ancestors of these people many warnings. He sent prophets to them who cried out and warned them and said, judgment is coming if you don't change. And they wouldn't listen. They refused to repent. They refused to turn away from their wicked deeds. And Zechariah says, remember what happened to them. Think about what happened to them. And what God is saying to you, verse 3, is this. Return to me, says the Lord of hosts, and I will return to you. Do not be like your fathers, to whom the former prophets cried out, return from your evil ways and your evil deeds, but they did not pay attention. Zechariah told the people they needed to turn to God. They needed to repent. They needed to change their attitude towards God. And verse 6 says this. So they repented and said, "As the Lord of hosts purposed to deal with us for our ways and deeds, so has he dealt with us." Can you see, these people listened to Zechariah. They did what God was telling them to do. They did change. They weren't like their fathers. Their whole attitude towards God has changed. They have returned to God. They're demonstrating that practically. They've obeyed his commands. They're starting to build his temple, his house. They've had a change of their heart, of their attitude, and they've changed their lifestyle and their practice. There's been a change on the inside, and there's been a change on the outside. There's been inward change and outward change. Now that is always the pattern when someone truly turns to God, when someone's truly converted, when someone truly becomes a Christian. There's an inward change. There's a change of attitude inside. There's real sorrow for the way that you've hurt and disobeyed God. There's a recognition of your guilt. There's a recognition that you deserve God's anger. That's what happened to these people, didn't they? They said, "As the Lord of hosts purposed to deal with us for our ways and deeds, so has he dealt with us." They said, God has been right. He's right to have sent this frustration into our lives. He's right not to have allowed our crops to grow. He's right to have sent this blight and this mildew because we were disobeying him. We had the wrong attitude towards him. God was right. And it's the same for us. We need to say that God is right to be angry with us. God is right to see our disobedience and to demand us to change. For everybody, there has to be that internal change of attitude, a turning towards God, a trusting in Christ. But when someone changes on the inside, they also change on the outside. It has to lead to outward changes. It has to change the way that we speak, and it has to change the way we behave. You have to stop doing the things that you know offend God. You have to start to pray and to care for other believers and to be part of a church and to be baptized. All the things that God has commanded us to do. It's not possible to have that inward, inside change and not be changed on the outside. And it's also not possible to do the other way around. It's not possible to change yourself on the outside and to remain unchanged on the inside. You know, some people try and do that. Some people will tell you they've become a Christian. They've trusted themselves to the Lord Jesus. But nothing changes in their life. They don't change the way they speak. They don't change the way they speak to their parents. They don't change the way that they act at work. And you say, well, then there's no evidence that they really have trusted Christ. If that inside change hasn't changed the outside, it can't be real. And then others try and do the other way around. They know there's something wrong with their life. They know that the way they speak and they act is wrong. And so they try and reform themselves. They try and change their outward behaviour. They try and change the way they act without being changed on the inside. Well, what about you? Ask yourself. Have you repented? Have you turned to God? Have you confessed your guilt and your sin to him? Have you turned to him inside? Have you changed your attitude towards him? And has that flowed out into a change of behaviour and words and the way you live? Have you turned to God internally and externally? Or are you trying to do the impossible? Are you trying to follow Christ while you cling on to a sin or a habit or a friendship or a hobby or a career which you know can't possibly work with obeying God? Or are you trying to change yourself, to change the way you act, without wholly committing your life and your heart and your soul and your mind and your strength to Christ? You know, neither of those is possible. It's not possible to contort yourself like that. Have you ever seen those pictures of those Indian rubber people who can put their legs behind their ears? It's not very natural, is it? There might be some people who can do that with their bodies, but we can't do that with our lives. And that's what you're trying to do if you're trying to change your outside and not the inside. Or change your inside and not the outside. It's a contortion that's not possible. If you're like that, then turn to God and obey him. Listen to his word and do it. Trust him and obey him. Love him and serve him. Don't try any longer to do the impossible. Don't try and do one without the other. We all need to be transformed inside and outside. And only Christ can enable you to do that. So go to him now, if that's what your need is. Don't put it off. And the wonderful thing about this is that that's what these people had done. These people have repented and they've obeyed. And now they are ready to hear this new message from God. This new message that's coming through Haggai. Let's listen to what God has to say to them. So we're told what Haggai is sent to do. He's sent to speak to the priests. These are the priests who are now serving in the building that's going to be the temple. There's an altar built. There's offerings, sacrifices being brought day by day. The people will be gathering there together regularly to make sacrifices. And Haggai is to go to that public place and he's to ask these questions to the priests. Now, Haggai knows what the answers are going to be. This is not a question of ignorance. He's using a device. These are rhetorical questions. Often a teacher will do that. They'll ask a question to the class or to someone else. And it's a teaching device. And it's supposed to get your interest. It's supposed to gain your attention and make you listen. And that's what's happening here. Haggai's asking these public questions to the priests. The priests are going to answer, so everyone hears the answers, and then in return, Haggai is going to respond with a message from God. So what are these questions? Well, the first one we read in verse 12. Haggai goes to the priests and he asks them this: if someone carries holy meat in the fold of his garment and touches with his fold bread or stew or wine or oil or any kind of food, does it become holy? The priests answered and said, no. So what we're talking about here is this holy meat. This is meat that's being offered as part of a sacrifice to God. That's what makes it holy. It's been set aside for God, for this great purpose of being offered to him. And the priests would carry it around because with these kind of sacrifices, they would be eating part of it. And as they carried it within their robe, the holiness, the specialness about that meat, and would make their robe holy as well. This is what it says in Leviticus chapter 6, verse 24. Let's talk about the sin offering. God says this, it is most holy. The priest who offers it for sin shall eat it. In a holy place it shall be eaten, in the court of the tent of meeting. Whatever touches its flesh shall be holy. So what you've got is this meat, part of a sacrifice, being held in a garment, and that garment has become holy. But Haggai's question is this. If the clothing in which the meat has been held then touches something else, another piece of clothing or some other food, does that other piece of clothing, does that other food become holy as well? Is this holiness like a contagious infection which is just passed on from one person to another? And we've had that experience in our family in the last few weeks, and it's not great. And the answer is, no, it's not like that. That holiness, that Old Testament idea of holiness, wasn't passed on. It just stopped with the priest's garment. So that was question one. But question two we find here in verse 13. Then Haggai said, if someone who is unclean by contact with a dead body touches any of these, does it become unclean? The priests answered and said, it does become unclean. Just remember this idea of uncleanness in the Old Testament. A dead body was unclean. If someone cut themselves and blood flowed out, that made them unclean. And if someone else then touched the dead body, they would become unclean. And if that person touched something else, then that would become unclean. And that's the point of this question. This uncleanness is like an infectious disease. It is passed on. Everything that's touched by something unclean then makes that unclean. That's what the priests are saying. Again, quoting from Leviticus, this time chapter 22, verse 5. And whoever touches a swarming thing by which he may be made unclean, or a person from which he may take uncleanness, whatever his uncleanness may be, the person who touches such a thing shall be unclean until the evening. So we've got these two ideas. Something that's holy, can that be passed on and on and on? No, it can't. Something that's unclean, can that be passed on and on and on? Yes, it can. That might seem a bit confusing. What's all this about? Why is Haggai asking those questions? What's so important? Well, here's the punchline in verse 14. What he's talking about, he's not really interested in holy meat and sacrifices. What he's interested in is the nation of Israel, these people. And God's nation was meant to be holy. They were meant to be set aside for God, like this sacrificial meat. They were supposed to be special for God himself. This is what God said in Exodus chapter 19, verse 5. Now, therefore, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, you shall be my treasured possession among all peoples, for all the earth is mine. And you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. So these people, this nation, is supposed to be holy. It's supposed to be set apart from God. It's supposed to be like an offering to God. But, says Haggai, so it is with these people and with this nation before me, and so with every work of their hands, and what they offer there is unclean. Instead of being holy, this nation have become unclean. They've become contagious and infectious. Their disobedience has made them a source of uncleanness, like a dead body. And that's spreading out and infecting the whole world. Everything they touch becomes unclean. They've become a source of infection. They've become dangerous. And these holy people, who are meant to be a kingdom of priests, bringing holy offerings to please God, their offerings are actually contaminated and horrible. They're bringing things to God which are an offence to him, a stink in his nostrils. That was true of the nation before they went into exile. That's why God's judgment came on them. And now Haggai is saying, the same thing has been true now, since you've turned away from faith and obedience. That's why everything's been going wrong for you. That's why when you come to a heap of 20 measures, there's only 10. That's why when you come to a vat of 50 measures, there are 20. That's why blight and mildew and hail have been falling on you. You've been unclean before God. And so he's not blessed you. He can't bless you, because they've refused to turn to him. Verse 17. I struck you and all the products of your toil with blight and mildew and with hail, yet you did not turn to me, declares the Lord. Now this might be a bit unfamiliar to us, but to these people it would have been a powerful picture. Remember, these ideas of holiness and uncleanness were deeply ingrained into Israelite consciousness. Now, people couldn't bear the idea of being unclean, and they would have shunned dead bodies and lepers and things which made them unclean. And when they became unclean, they would wash themselves and cleanse themselves. It was deeply important to them to stay clean. And things which were holy, they had to be so careful about, not to contaminate them. That food that was set aside to God, that was important that it stayed holy. So these are ideas that are there in their minds. And now God is saying, you are all unclean. You're contaminating. You're just spreading out horrible uncleanness. It must have been a real shock to them to realize that. And you know, that's not just true of those people. That's true of every single human being. Not because we've touched dead bodies, not because we've been in contact with a leprous person, not because we cut ourselves, but because of our sin and our shame. The wrong things we say and the wicked things we do, those make us unclean. Jesus said, it's what comes out of the heart of a man that makes you unclean. And that's all of us. By nature, we're unclean, we're infectious. it's impossible for us to serve God or to bring him offerings or to please him. Never ever imagine that you can come to God in your own goodness. All of us naturally are unclean and unfit for God. That was shocking for the Israelites to hear. And it's shocking for us. You know, the idea of thinking that you can come to God and please him. It's like someone who's got a vomiting and diarrhea bug, deciding that they'll go into a hospital operating theatre. You just wouldn't do it, would you? No one would let you anywhere near it, because that would be so dangerous. And yet people think that they can come into God's presence unclean, sinful, infectious. It's impossible. This was a shocking thing for these people to hear. But, and there is a wonderful but. Remember the day this message came. God isn't saying this to bring these people to shame or to despair. Verse 18 says this: consider from this day forward, from the 24th day of the ninth month. God is saying something has changed. And we know what it is. These people themselves have changed. They've repented. They've turned to the Lord. They've obeyed him. Since the day the foundation of the Lord's temple was laid, consider. There's been a total change. From the moment they turn to God, they are no longer unclean and unfit for God. They are now holy. The situation has been reversed. That's the point about this. Consider, things have changed. The only problem is that the change is invisible. You know, this idea of holiness and cleanness wasn't something you could see. And you can't see, and I can't see, when someone's been forgiven by God, when someone's been cleansed by God. You can't identify someone who's trusting Christ by looking at them. You can't see that someone's been changed from being under God's curse to being under his blessing. And that's true for these people as well. You know, in the Old Testament, God did link his blessing to physical blessings. Remember that? We thought about this a few weeks ago. God said to his people, if you obey me, if you keep my commands, then I will bless you. Your harvests will multiply. You'll always have enough food. And now these people have repented, they have changed. Those promises are going to come true. But they can't see it yet. You know, so far their harvests have been blighted. They've experienced drought and mildew and hail. But you can't change that overnight. That's the point of verse 19. Is the seed yet in the barn? Indeed, the vine, the fig tree, the pomegranate and the olive tree have yielded nothing. Yes, these people have repented, but God hasn't changed the order of the seasons. It's not harvest time yet. This isn't the time where you'd see figs on the fig trees and grapes on the grapevine. In fact, this time of the year in December, the commentators tell me they would have planted seed ready for a spring harvest. But it hasn't come yet. And it won't come yet. So far they can't see any effect. They've planted seed, but it hasn't grown yet. It's not in the barn. They're going to have to wait till the spring, because the change that's happened is invisible. But, and this is the wonderful but, and this is what we see at the end of verse 19. God says to them, okay, you can't see there's been a change. You can't see. But from this day on, I will bless you. God says to them, from this day, from the 24th day of the ninth month of the second year of King Darius, from today, you are back under my blessing. Your status has changed. You are no longer unclean. You are holy. And I am going to bless you. I promised that back in Leviticus. I promised. You can't see it happen yet. You can't see the seed sprouting yet. But I absolutely guarantee that from this day on, you will have a harvest this spring. And your grapes will grow. And your olives will grow. And your pomegranates will grow. And when you go to draw 20 measures, you'll find 40 measures. And when you go to draw 50 measures of wine, you'll draw 100 measures. I am going to bless you. From this day forward, everything has changed. Nothing is visible, but everything is different. The years of blight and frustration and failure are over. And God is going to defend them and protect them and keep them and preserve them. What a promise. From this day on, I will bless you. They're still going to have to wait. These people, through these winter months, are still going to have to work. They're still going to have to put stone upon stone on the temple. They're still perhaps going to be hungry and short of food because their harvests have been so poor. But they know that come the spring, they have an absolute guarantee of harvest. And they know that God is going to protect them and bless them. And they know that their labours are going to be successful. And that's going to be such a huge help. You know, hope and assurance, just psychologically, they're so helpful, aren't they? If you know that what you're going to do is going to succeed, if you know that what you're going to do is going to get you where you plan to be, that just keeps you going. And that's going to keep these people going. And it's not just a hope that something might happen. It's an absolute guarantee from God. They can look back to this day in a month's time when they're feeling hungry and tired and worn out. They can say, on the 24th day of the ninth month, God promised that he will bless us. And when they go out to the fields and they see the first sprouts of their harvest coming up, they'll say, God promised. And this won't be eaten by locusts. And this won't be destroyed by blight. It's going to be a full harvest. They can look back to that day. And they can say, this is the day when everything changed. When we knew that God was blessing us again. This is the anniversary we're going to remember. What a promise. From this day on, I will bless you. And that brings us back to us, to me and to you. What's your position? Are you unclean or are you holy? Have you turned to God through Christ? Have you repented and obeyed him? Have you gone from being unclean and under God's curse to coming under his blessing? Do you have real hope and assurance and reason to work and serve him faithfully and joyfully? Can you take hold of this promise and say, God has said to me, from this day on, I will bless you. He said that to every one of his true people who has come to him. It's invisible. I can't look at you and see if that great change has happened in you. But if it has happened, it's a totally real change. It will lead to God's blessing on you now and forever. It doesn't guarantee you wealth and prosperity and fertility in this world, but it does in the world to come. And it does guarantee God's love and care and protection for you now. And it will flow out into a life of obedience and love for God and happiness and contentment in him. Has that great change happened for you, in you? Well, if it hasn't, why not come to him now? Why not turn to him and ask him to forgive you for your wasted life and for your uncleanness? Why not trust Christ, who's made a way for you to come under God's blessing by taking your uncleanness onto himself on the cross? It'd be wonderful in years to come to look back and say, it was the 17th of February 2019. That was the great day when God changed me. From that day on, God has been blessing me.